I've known Huey for so long because many of his friends of our vintage call him Huey, and I suspect now you're called Huey, the more formal name. In any event, I do appreciate the kind introduction. I tried to warn people about this business, about leading, listening, all the things that I've done over time. And I don't do that anymore because a few years ago I was asked to say some words at a university function. And I said to Alan McDonald, who was the chairman of the evening, there were four speakers, and I said, Alan, you may know him, he was an official orator at the University of Calgary, a great big handsome guy with a bushy beard and a wonderful speaker, and it's always intimidating to speak after him in any event. So I said, Alan, for God's sake, don't go through a long laundry list. Nobody really gives a damn. They won't remember it anyway. And just tell them I'm a butcher's son from Gleeson. I said, okay, Haskane. So came my turn to speak, and Al said, well, the next speaker is Haskane. Many of you know him in the room here. He said he's been around the university a long time. All he wanted you to know is that he's a butcher's son from Gleeson. And people kind of chuckled a little bit, and he said, the only thing I can tell you about him, he's skewered a lot of people in the boardroom over time. So anymore, Huey, I don't tell people what to say. Well, I first of all congratulate all the award winners. It's impressive as to what's happened and the things that have written, and they are important in our history, and thank God some people are keeping track of them. And in my case, without singling him out, Harley Hotchkiss, of course, has been such a great friend of mine and business associate for, I guess, more than four decades. Harley and you and Becky are two of our very best friends. And anyway, I was happy when he wrote this book, Hat Trick. You know, he's so damn modest. He said, oh, what would I write about? Well, this turned out to be a wonderful book, and I was honored to have read it before, and I said, well, Harley, it's a wonderful book, but you're pretty frank about some of these things. You really want to say that? He said, Dick, that's the way it happened, and that's the way I'm saying it. So if you have read it, you'll see some of those comments. I guess while he's won many, many awards, I think most people don't fully appreciate that he has recently received the Order, the Companion of Canada, and the Order of Canada is an important, impressive recognition anyway. Having sat on the advisory committee in earlier times, there's the member of the Order of Canada, there's an officer of the Order of Canada, and there's only about 150 at any one time with the Companion of the Order of Canada. So I don't know any greater award than you could get in our country to such a well-deserving person, because Harley's only one of about four people in this whole community has ever received it. So Harley, on that, congratulations again, old buddy. So anyway, Clint, how long do I get to speak here? I don't want to bore people.
25 minutes.
Anyway, I guess before I carry on, I usually tell this to students when I talk to them, because they look at you and they say, Christ, here's a 75-year-old guy up there speaking. What am I supposed to learn from him? They don't really say it, but I know that's what they're thinking. And so I put a cautionary note in and say, well, you must realize about something about what I'm going to say. It may be a little out of date, but nevertheless, I'm going to tell you. And you may have a different opinion, which is fine. And I remind them, Harley, of a Ken King story, which is right in this club here a few years ago, when Ken King took over as the new president of the Calgary Flames. And he's such a wonderful speaker, and he was introducing, I think, Larry Bettman at a breakfast. And he was so enthused about this new job, and he said, look, I've got this job as the president of Flames. I'm going to love it. He said, I'm an old hockey player myself. And he said, I've always had this big question about who is the best hockey player ever in the world. And he said, now I get the chance to meet all the coaches, the players, the history, and all the owners. And he said, I've been working on this thing for a few months now. And he said, I don't think I quite have the answer about who is the best hockey player. But he said, I think last week I came pretty close in talking to Lanny McDonald and Jim Papinski. And he said, well, the thing you have to understand, Ken, is the older we get, the better we were. I don't think that just applies to hockey players. In any event, the book came about, unlike Harley, the last thing I thought I would do is write a book. But Dominic D'Alessandro, who is a great friend of mine, who is the CEO of Manulife, one of the outstanding chief executives in the country, I was on his board and we hired him and sat on the board for many years. And then when TransCanada had some trouble, we got him on the board, and he's an outstanding person. when he was retiring from the Trans-Canada Board, when I was retiring from the Trans-Canada Board, at least, he said to me, Haskane, and he's a guy that doesn't just give compliments easy, he said, Haskane, you should write a book. I said, why? He said, because of all the executives I've known in the corporate world in Canada, you've been involved in more actual transactions than anybody I know, as opposed to investment bankers and lawyers who get involved in many of them. And he said, you've had to live through that, and I think if nothing else, you should do it for the benefit of the business school. And I said, hell, I don't even write good letters. How can I write a book? And then Dick Wilson, who many of you know, who is a public relations officer of Alberta Energy Company, came after me with the same thing. He said, you should really document some of this stuff. And so one day, I said, I can't write a book. So one day he said, I want you to meet a fellow who's in town, and it turned out to be this fellow, Paul Gresko, that Harley just mentioned. And so he came in and said, well, he'd do this book, or he'd help it, and it wasn't a lot of money and so on, so we decided in half an hour that would be worthwhile. It turned out to be more time than I'd ever imagined. And the end result, of course, is this book, Northern Tigers. I said, it's not about me. I don't believe in that. But if the deals we've been involved with and people have some understanding of how they came about and the end result, perhaps it would be useful. So anyway, the book got published. Because partway through originally I was planning on just paying for it ourselves. And he said, well, there's enough information in here that may be publishable, which is not easy to do, I guess, in Canada. So anyway, we selected a publisher, and the rest is history. So the reason was really to try to provide some background information on transactions and how they came about and the ones that worked and some of the ones that didn't, because they've affected literally thousands of people, including a lot of people in this town. So the book has 15 chapters in it. The first chapter and the last chapter relate to my life in Gleeson, and the last chapter relates to an award we were given down there to name the street after me. So all the chapters in between are specific chapters with respect to individual transactions, starting with the Hudson Bay oil and gas story and on to a number of other stories that all of you know something about. And the interesting part for me, I guess, in retrospect, is that now the book is become more popular than I ever would have expected. And you know the people that are buying it? And you don't make any money on it, by the way. But but the people that are picking the book up and coming to get me to sign it off and are people whose kids will say, you worked all your life at Home Oil or Hudson's Bay Oil and Gas or Dome Petroleum. And I go downtown and I see this Dome Petroleum building and I see the Home Oil building and there's nobody in it. Or at least there's no company there anymore. And we all in this room know all the stories, and so we don't even question that. And so they're buying the book and giving it to their kids and say, this is a story about what happened to Dome Petroleum or Hudson's Bay or, in this case, McMillan Goodell and all these other companies, which have now disappeared from the scene. So embedded in there, I hope, are a lot of, information and observations about corporate governance. A lot of observations, biases perhaps, or I hope facts about the importance of head offices and what happens when you lose it, and the importance of Canadian ownership, and I've been involved in some debates there. Some people agree and some disagree, and I think Huey, you wanted me to talk a little bit about that later. And also the role of a board in selecting chief executives. I've been involved in the appointment of 7 different CEOs and departure of some, all on an ethical and professional basis. And so I hope some of those things will make an impression on particularly young people. And they seem to. The kids in the business school that I talk to are quite fascinated because they don't know a lot of the stuff that's in there, and hopefully it's reasonably readable. So I guess from my point of view, there, in mergers and acquisitions, there's a statistic that some people have used over time that have studied this, that only one merger in 5 are successful. And I think that probably if you go through history, that's true. And I don't have that specific history, but I can tell you some of the mergers and deals that are included in here that I think are positive, and I can tell you some that were negative. And maybe out of this information, perhaps people that are in executive positions in the future can and get some feeling as to how that happened. And the positive ones, for example, are the Trans-Canada thing, and quite frankly, the merger with Nova and Harley, I guess, was 1998. And there were a bunch of things that happened. We took a huge write-down, we cut the dividend, the stock went from $20 to less than 10, and we were within a whisker, quite frankly, of getting taken over by a U.S. company. And that's another issue about foreign ownership, but as a classic example, we're lucky in some respects that that company is still here, and it's grown enormously and is one of the best pipeline companies in North America. So I think that's a positive, but it surely wasn't so positive when we did all those other things, Harley. In all my corporate life, as an executive or as a board member, I took more personal flack, and I mean flack, mean-spirited, what they thought were appropriate comments about cutting the dividend, than I've taken in my entire corporate life, even as the chairman, kind of behind the scenes. In fairness, if we hadn't done that, TransCanada wouldn't be here today, so I guess that's a defensive comment. I won't comment on all of these. Obviously, the Fording coal transaction, where Fording was, as you may know, the second largest exporter of metallurgical coal in the world, was owned by CP and was spun off from the CP. And consequently, it was a public company. I became the chairman. I'd been on the board for many years. It's a classic company, a well-run company. Bill Stinson, who used to be the president of CP, said it was the best-run division that's in the whole CP organization. In any event, in that instance, you might remember we had a hostile takeover challenge from Sherritt International and the Ontario Teachers. Interestingly enough, the guy running Sherritt is Ian Delaney, who's a longtime friend of mine and sat on boards. But anyway, as it turned out, we had a great defense and we turned it into a trust. Of course, the rest is history. And then it was sold at least to a Canadian company and sold to Teck. And now Teck is on a roll with the result. So I consider that a success because most people don't realize that if we had basically put it on the market in looking for the highest bid, BP, BHP, or Rio Tinto could have taken that company over with petty cash. It was a multi-billion-dollar deal, but in the scheme of things. So I feel proud that we as directors didn't just say, what's the highest shareholder value? We worked like hell to create an alternative. And I think those are lessons that people need to learn. And when I get into the negatives on some of these things, you'll hear me talking negatively about the oil and the mining industry, where I can maybe say that right now, where I think in 2003 there were 12 mining companies in Canada out of the top 40 in the world. In the last number of years there have been 7 of them that are not here anymore. And so it's a classic example, in my view, and I say it in the book, it's easy to complain about it, but if the mining industry had not basically said, I'm looking for the highest potential price, but put some combinations together like Inco and Falconbridge and Teck and so on, those companies would still be here today. If we had done that with Alberta Energy Company and Pan Canadian, essentially, Harley, put them on the block to look for the highest possible price for the short term, then Canada wouldn't be here today. We worked out a deal and put it together. So I think there are some lessons there, and I think business schools have to learn about it, because you have a broader obligation not only to shareholders but also to the country and to your employees, and I feel very strongly about that. So anyway, other ones that I'm happy about are Enbridge. Of course, used to be Interprovincial Pipeline. It was owned originally by Imperial Oil and Gulf and other companies. I became the chairman of that, and of course it was a great pipeline company. In those days it wasn't doing a lot because we didn't need the capacity, and of course people would move there. Pat Daniel worked with me at Hudson's Bay Oil and Gas. He was a great engineer, and now he runs one of the best pipeline companies. The two best pipeline companies in North America today, in my view, are Enbridge and TransCanada, headquartered right here. Of course, TransAlta has done well. Steve Snyder, we hired him. He changed the direction of that company. And, of course, CP in itself, Canadian Pacific, is headquartered here, the railway. You'll remember that the big split of the CP organization into 5 components was called the Sunburst or whatever. And two of those companies that came out of that, the ships and the hotels, have been taken over. But the other companies, we talked about 40, is where it wound up, and it's in the hands of Tech. And of course, Encana itself was formed out of the combination of AEC and Pan Canadian, and of course, it's the railway itself. So I think that's a success, and certainly from shareholders' point of view, they did well out of the old CP stock. The negative ones, in my view, that I don't like, and I was involved with them, but we tried our best, was McMillan Bodell, which was Canada's premier forest company. I was the chairman there, and they ran into some hard times, and eventually were taken over by Weyerhaeuser. And you know, people say we can blame the Americans, they've taken us over. The fact is, we brought that on ourselves. It was a poorly managed company. They got into businesses they didn't understand. They didn't do a good job of promoting management. And we worked like hell, I can tell you, to find a Canadian alternative. But as it turned out, that didn't work. And so Weyerhaeuser, in many ways, brought a lot of good things to Canada, better than McMillan Bodell had, but not the head office. So the head office is not here anymore. So the old McMillan Bodell operations are a fraction of what they were before. I don't like it, but I don't. We tried the best we could, and we didn't have a solution. The other negatives, of course, are the Dome Hudson's Bay deal. I mean, I don't think there were any winners out of that. Everybody lost. The government lost on its taxes. The shareholders of Dome lost. Certainly Hudson's Bay was lost. It was a wonderful company. If it had survived, in my view, it would have been one of the prime companies today. We were, in terms of exploration production success back even then in 1981, we were at the top of the list, and we had this enormous land spread, but what happened happened. And of course now those assets of Hudson's Bay, of course, went to Dome, and from Dome to Amoco, and now to BP. But anyway, I still have a little pension that comes from BP. So those are some negative ones. The Crestar, which was a spin-off, again, from the old Hudson Bay assets. You remember that was owned by Amoco at the time. They spun it off into a public company, and I was a director of that. And Barry Jackson, we hired as the CEO, and he's a very good executive. I followed him closely, and he's now replaced me as the chairman of TransCanada. So I wouldn't say it's a negative. It was folded into Gulf, and then Gulf was folded into Conoco, and Conoco are a large player here now, and I think a good one. I talked about the mining things that still upset me, where this used to be a great mining country in terms of the financing of these mining companies, that because you lose the head office, you still have some of the mines, but the fact of life is we're losers. It's a loss for employees, it's a loss for technical people, and so on, but what's done is done. The reason I get upset about it, and this is where it gets into Canadian ownership policies, because today in this country, people have more money to invest than we've ever had as individuals. We have RRSPs, and we have RIFs, and we've accumulated some capital. And we have some fairly large pools of capital, even with respect to the world. We have our things like the Heritage Trust Fund, we have the fund in BC, we have Ontario Teachers, we have the Canada Pension Fund, OMERS. And, you know, they're large, fairly large accumulations of capital. And here they are searching all over the world for investment opportunities, when many of the opportunities are right in front of them, and really, by virtue of not being imaginative enough, in my view, to put some of these combinations together or force them, or encourage them, I think we could have done better. Anyway, that leads me then, I can talk about a lot of others. I can talk about the Reichmans, who took over Gulf, and that was a failure in my view. I knew Paul Reichman, he was on the board with me at CIBC, a very smart guy, but got way beyond their depth in terms of the businesses they were trying to run. Remember, they took over Abitibi. So the rest is history. We wrote off $1 billion of their debt to CIBC. So I've been involved with people of that magnitude in terms of the deals they were doing. In terms of foreign ownership, some people may not agree with me on this, but I put forward together, actually, believe it or not, a proposal with the people that think as I do, I guess, on this one. I've done all the work on it with Peter Lougheed, Dominic D'Alessandro, and Steve Jaroslawski from Montreal, They don't really publish it, but the essence of it is this, is that what foreign investors want in any country, you want to know what the guidelines are. Say, tell me the guidelines and I'll tell you whether I want to invest there or not. And the best thing that's ever happened to this country is some simple legislation in the Bank Act. The Bank Act simply says nobody, foreign or otherwise, can own more than 20% of a bank. And you have to have a majority of Canadians on the board. You have to have a head office. Well, if it hadn't been for that thing, the Canadian banks wouldn't be there today. I got to tell you that. And Manulife, which is Canada's, North America's largest insurance company today, under D'Alessandro, took over John Hancock. He will be the first to tell you that without that 20% protection, he would not be here today. That company would have been gone. It was a mutual company. We turned it into a public company. So I think that's an example today where the Canadian banks, as we all know, are the strongest banks in the world. So based on that theory and based on some other examples, Alberta Energy is a good example. When it was cranked out, you remember, in the public, it was the maximum anybody could own was 20%. When Petro-Canada was turned into a public company, the maximum was 20%. Well, it hasn't hurt those companies. Investment bankers will tell you it depresses the stock and a whole bunch of crap. It hasn't. Quite frankly, I don't care what they say. Ron Brenneman doesn't like that because I said that to the press one time. He said, Christ, Haskane, I thought you were a friend of mine. So I said, I don't care who owns the 20%, even if the government owns it, which they did, as long as there are good members on the board, and even if Exxon wants to own it, as long as the company is transparent and is well managed, how do we care? But anyway, those are some private issues. So our position, rightly or wrongly, is that large resource companies, where the resources are primarily in this country, and the company is public, that we should put some kind of restriction similar to the banks. It doesn't have to be 20%, it could be 40% or a big enough number. Because if we use Encana as an example, over half their stock's held in the U.S. in any event. And I see nothing wrong if somebody wanted to take a direct 40% interest in Encana. I'd see nothing much wrong with it. They may even add to the benefits that all shareholders get. And I would think the same about some other organization like the Potashes of the world and so on, where there are big natural resource companies. And I think that investors will understand that. Now, if you want to put money directly in and you want to build a new oil sands mine or you want to build something direct, come on. You have the same guide as anybody. You don't have to share that other than through royalties or whatever. But these companies that have been established and are operating in a public environment, in my view, could well stand some protection with no real hurt to them and might even add to the country. So that's a position that we would like to take. And the reason for it is that Canadians deserve an opportunity to be able to invest in these companies. We have the money and the resources, and yet we're not discriminating really against foreign owners. So whether that will go, the reason we haven't published this is because the next time there's a big foreign takeover, which there could be, of one of these public companies, it's going to become a very important issue for governments. And they're going to need some guidelines, presumably some alternatives, as to how they might solve the problem. In fairness, there was a study done, headed by Red Wilson, and the report was issued in June of 2008. Murray Edwards from here was on that thing, and it was a good attempt to try to address the issues that we've been talking about. I don't think they came down as hard. I made a presentation to them, but so did Dominic and others. But they're headed in the right direction, and they've highlighted the importance of head offices, because people will say, well, the mines are still there, the oil's still there, but when you lose a head office, this town wouldn't be what it is today if we had a bunch of 100% owned subsidiaries of somebody else. So in any event, those are some of my views, Huey, on the foreign ownership issues. And we are now used, I guess, in Australia. The chairman of BHP a year or so ago, and this was when we were losing all these mining companies, he said Canada was among the mining nations of the world, and that's where I quote it. We had 12 industrial companies out of the top 40 in the world, and today we're down by 7. And he said, and he was trying to defend it, and he said, this is not what we need to do in Australia, because if they were concerned about being taken over themselves, the BHP. Anyway, I've gone on and rambled on. I'd be glad to answer questions. And thank you for the opportunity of being here. Questions?
Well, having just gone through this at Shell, loss of our head office in Canada, I can certainly sympathize with what you're...
I had it in here. I was going to talk about that, because I have a wonderful relationship with Shell on the oil sands projects, and you know, Jack McLeod is a great friend, and Bill Daniel, some of the best executives in this country over the years, come from Shell. And in my view, the maybe even Shell's point of view, international, I'm not sure that that did a lot of good taking out the balance. I was happened to be a shareholder, because it's not nearly as transparent. You have a hard time finding who the CEO is. You don't know where the decisions are made. The major ones are made somewhere else, and they could still be. But at least when you had 20% ownership or whatever is Canadians, and you had a very good board, and I don't see any redeeming features in that. If you're sitting in The Hague or London, you can say, yes, well, we don't have this bother of a public ownership. But I'm telling you, there's a pros and cons of that. In the world I grew up in with Hudson's Bay and Gas, we grew to be bigger than Amoco, and Conoco only owned 50% of it because we had other shareholders. We were much more responsive. We did a lot of our own financing. And so anyway, they might not like that, but
good.
I would ask your opinion.
Yes. Certainly didn't mean to preempt any questions from the audience, so please jump up. And
Dick, is there any danger, if I can use that word, from Asia or the Middle East insofar as taking over major positions in Canadian entities?
Herb, I got to tell you, I use that as an example when I'm talking about the government policy. And for a number, this is in the last few years, I've said it publicly, and I really believe it. When they were doing this this book, I said, I'm telling you, if we don't come down with some guidelines on this thing, one of these days the government is going to be faced with a very difficult situation. And I used the example. I said, one of these days, the Chinese in particular, or the Japanese, are going to come along, they're going to make a bid for Suncor, a very good operation, a widely held company. They're going to make a bid for it, and they're going to make it at a price that's so attractive, people will take it. Because the average person will say, to hell with it, I'm going to take it. And then what's going to happen, they're going to say, by the way, that oil is going to go to the West Coast, and we already know that Enbridge will build a pipeline, and so that's what we're going to do. And therefore, the government is in a very difficult position. First of all, under the national or under NAFTA, as you probably know, we have a sharing agreement with the United States, so it would put that in jeopardy. It would put our own, I guess, supply issues in jeopardy, and it would be a very tough thing to answer. And so, that's, I don't know if it's still possible, but unless you come down with some guidelines, I think that those could happen. On the other hand, if you want to come in and direct investment, well, I have no problem with that. If you want to put your own money in, take the risk, bring your technology, hair on you. If you later want to go public, well, that's up to you. Sorry, yeah?
Jassy, I'm wondering, obviously, foreign capital is a critical resource development in Canada. I think historically, 40-50% here in Calgary in terms of foreign capital contribution. Do you envision a model where we retain domestic ownership of a party and then do sort of a joint venture structure as opposed to having them as a shareholder in the operating company? So it takes a 60-40 of an oil sands project, whereas and we retain 100% of our domestic company. Is that a better model, or do you see that as the same thing as just having them have a direct stake in that?
I don't, you know, there are many models that can take place. Some of it is driven by tax, others driven by the foreign ownership or the nature of the owner and a whole bunch of things. So I don't have an actual, all I can say is that the outcome, certainly if possible, Canadians should have a chance to invest in it. They don't have to invest, they get no priorities, but there's more capital in this country today than we recognize. We're always short of capital. We, you know, when TransCanada was built and these other companies, they didn't have the resources in this country. And so it was financed by big international companies. the world has changed. And so I don't really have the model, because each one, I think, could be different depending on the type of business, like an Enbridge, for example. Financing and how you do that is totally different than it would be for some other type of pipeline. Anyway.
I did have one question.
Yeah.
I find the inclusion of the word ethical in the title of the book kind of intriguing. This kind of begs a question as to what would be kind of unethical in these contexts.
Well, I think that's fairly easy. In fact, I had that same question last night, or the night before, it was from the MBA class at the university. They were talking about ethics, because what's happening now, the business schools, you look at Harvard, they're now saying, we need a code of ethics, we need you to sign something. Well, it's a bloody awful late to talk about ethics. They should have been doing that. So I really mean that, with all due respect to Harvard. And I even held up a headline of the business from here, where they're actually teaching some ethics in the business school in 2003. And I've been harping on this thing myself. Nobody listens, but I've been harping since 1997. I got an honorary degree and had a convocation speech talking about the ethics in business. And right after that, of course, some people were saying that business ethics is an oxymoron. It's just there aren't ethics in business. I don't believe that. So I think we had to keep hammering away on it. And then, of course, we had the Enrons of the world. We had the Briexes here. And so I'm not sure you can teach ethics. I mean, you're either ethical or you're not. You learn a hell of a lot of that before you get out of school. But you can talk about some of the consequences of it and the kind of decisions as business leaders you'll face. And you probably know Skilling, who was the CEO of Enron, was one of the outstanding graduates from Harvard. They bragged about him, and before that, after he graduated, he was with McKinsey, and he was an outstanding guy. Some of us in this room had dealings with that firm, with Enron. And they bragged about him so much, and one of the classic illustrations of the guy's ethics, if you will, was when he was in business school. Some of his classmates would tell you the story that they were talking about a drug, I think it was a tobacco company, Clint. And the question was, if you're the CEO of that tobacco company and you had concrete evidence and reports about the medical impact of tobacco, what would you do about it? He didn't even think twice about it. He said, my job is the return on shareholders' equity. The job of looking after the health of the public is the government's job, period. You know, so, I mean, today, a little easier to answer. But. That it? Time for a drink. Thanks very much for the invitation.
Okay, Nick, before you leave there, I'd like to present you with a set of our historical